Welcome to Season 3 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we have our intro. We have some talk about Melee. Instead of a tip of the week, we're going to have Alex ranting crazily, and then we'll have some closing comments.
Still counts. It's episode 12, and I'm somewhat disappointed about the feedback we got from our last episode, John.
It was exceptional. I don't know what the issue was. People told me how interested they are in the history of the mountain that I'm providing. And because of that, I've actually done further research. It's kind of, I'll say, a hobby or an obsession with me now. Did you ever hear the story of Sir William met the mountain? Have you heard this story before? Do you know who Sir William is? Well, he was a minor noble from the Lannisters, and they actually set him up with a pretty good gig in King's Landing. He was a custom agent, basically, so he interacted with all the merchants that came by. Very social man. But his work involved a lot of interaction with people, and after about 3 to 4 years of doing this, he just got completely sick of hanging out with people and having to go to all these functions at King's Landing, these parties and everything, and he just needed some time alone. So he decided to go way out in the middle of nowhere, just, you know, off in Lannister land. And he took this nice house. The closest village was about maybe a half day horse ride away, and he was just alone. And he was like that for about 5 months or so, and he started to get a little stir crazy. And just at the point where he decided that he really wanted some interaction with someone else, he had a knock on his door one day. And when he opened the door, there was this giant of a man standing out. You guessed it, Alex. It was the mountain. So the mountain's standing there, and William looks up, and he goes, "Hi." And the mountain says, "I'm your neighbor from down the road. And I'm having a party tomorrow, and I was wondering if you'd like to come." And William was like, "Wow, I was just thinking to myself that I hadn't seen a person in about 6 months, and it would be really nice to actually see some people and talk to them." And the mountain said to him, "Great, so I hope you'll come tomorrow, but I should tell you, there's some drinking that goes on at my parties." And William said, "I'm from King's Landing. I can drink with the best of them. We used to have the most crazy, outlandish parties you'd ever see." And the mountain says, "Well, Mr. William, I should warn you about another thing. Sometimes there's some sex at my parties." And when he goes, "Oh my God, I haven't had sex in 6 months. That's not going to be a problem for me. That would be fantastic." And he goes, "Finally, I should tell you one other thing. Sometimes there's some fighting at my parties, William." And William goes, "Oh, well, I'm a pretty sociable guy. I don't think that'll be a problem." Mountain says, "Great, I'll see you tomorrow." And he starts to walk away. And William says to the mountain, One last thing, sir. What should I wear? What kind of party it is?" And the mountain looks back and goes, "Doesn't matter. Just gonna be you and me."
All right. On to things that have nothing to do with the mountain. This is the week that Calm Over Westeros is supposed to come out, this Thursday. So that's the 21st for North America. And, you know, distribution problems aside, hopefully shortly for other areas as well. All the cards have already been spoiled, so I expect that they'll all be on CardGameDB probably by the time most people are listening to this on Monday or Tuesday.
A lot of great cards in this cycle. Some really interesting things.
That's like the most generic thing you can say without giving any specific advice.
I love the Iron Mines.
Okay.
You know, saves.
Not very controversial, but very specific.
I love Miri. The 7-cost Targaryen new character. There's a lot of good characters in there. I think a lot of interesting combinations are available with this pack. It'll shake the meta up a little bit.
Yeah, speaking of the meta, actually, I've been seeing some somewhat interesting things. Our local games night, I had a couple of matches where I was playing Stark versus Martell, and just so many things were going my way. You know, I was having icons stripped regularly. It was a Martell stag, and I had Motleys on my characters, and I just realized how well equipped the deck was. I didn't really know it was. I hadn't built it for that, but to deal with this situation. Caitlyn will stop any Motley triggers, so I had no problem with those. I just had to make sure that she was being declared alongside whoever it was. And then when he started stripping my icons, I still had Wardens of the North and Winterfell Kennel Masters to make sure that I could get characters with no icons into the challenges I needed them in. And his big threat was a really high-strength Quentin, which I'm beginning to like that card, even though I thought I wouldn't. And Gaston Grey. I could just make sure Caitlyn was in that challenge, even when she didn't have the icons, and deny the triggers on both of those so that he couldn't kill Quentin and he couldn't use Gaston Grey on my characters with power, and eventually just managed to grind that out despite having severe card disadvantage. I was really impressed with how, despite not having been built for it, the deck seemed to have an answer to all of these things that were being thrown at me. It's a lot of fun.
That's great. A lot of tournaments are happening right now.
There are two tournaments, one of which was Lannister win.
We're talking about the two big tournaments. What was the other win?
The other one was Avera Fealty. Oh. The first one was the first one in the order they finished was the Saragossa tournament, which had 74 players. In the field, 17 were playing Targ and 17 were playing Lanny. So that was only 22%. I was right. Lower than 38%. I had it right. Five Lanny in the top 16. Five Barra in the top 16 as well. So clearly Barra doing very, very well in that field. And Barra Fealty took it in the end versus Lanny Crossing. So congratulations to Victor Lopez, who is the victor, I guess.
And Buzz took down the tournoi, the Tournament of the Hand in France. Much bigger field with Lannister Crossing.
He did. It was 127 players, and there the field was a little more Lanny heavy. It was a
33%.
31% Lanny.
Yeah.
And Targ and Stark were the next up at about 14%. So a lot of Lanny in the cut, 12 in the cut, but all eight factions were in the cut. Two Night's Watch were in the cut. But the buzz was Lanny versus a Targ deck, and it wound up being the Targ's deck, only loss of the tournament. So Buzz and his beard won that for Lannister. I was very torn. I didn't want Lannister to win because people will continue to moan about it. But I like Buzz. I like his beard. So I guess either way I won.
I guess. And do you know what, was it a Fealty Targ deck? What was the agenda?
I don't actually know yet. And I know that the stats for both that one and Saragossa will be in the annals within the next day or two. Just these bigger ones. The organizers typically need a day to sleep and recover.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, so that's two more. Now, it's worth noting that neither of these were in Wolves of the North metas. Wolves of the North had been released in both France and Spain, but just a few days prior and had not been incorporated into the tournament. So we may again see a shift as things go through. I think it still speaks to Lannister doing very well, but I think the big story of that is really Barra, that was a very small portion of the Saragossa field, and five of them, as many as the Lannisters, made the cut.
Well, Barra plays very well against, guess what? Lannister.
Well, yeah, but they do once they get the challenges phase Neil from the Even-Handed Judgment. That's a huge bonus to them, and they didn't have it here.
Yeah, so imagine how much better they're going to be with that.
Well, I hope we won't have to imagine for long. I think that, it's definitely going to be making a showing. I think Even-Handed Justice is a better event for Barra than Tower of the Hand is in the Lannister decks that are currently being used. But maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But I think Barra gets more than Lanny from the box.
I do too. I think Barra really gets a good push with that event.
Yeah, next week is HBO, isn't it?
Yeah. The show, I was about to say, the show starts on the 24th, 23rd?
24th, I think. It is still the 24th. Sunday slot. So, that's another thing that's happening.
I hear. And the week after that, it's Dance with Dragons in New York, which is a big event people should try to make it to.
You'll be attending that, right?
I will be there, yeah, as well as three other Ottawa people. I don't know if I'll win it, Alex, but, you know, I'll play my best. That's a tough meta. We're not going to an easy meta. I hear the Brotherhood Without Magic guys are going to be there. Of course, New York is home to some of the best players around, too. And if Washington comes up, it'll be a strong event.
Oh, Washington barely showed up to their own regional.
Well, I mean, we were talking with Seth today, and he was telling us he's got a couple store championships under his belt, and so do some of the other Washington guys. So it's not like they're out and not playing. So today we're here to talk about a very important topic that sometimes in the frenzy of Joust playing we forget about, and that's Melee. It's one of the two huge components of this game. It's extremely fun, and because Melee is competitive, we brought a competitive player on to talk about it with us, and one that's been at several final tables at huge Melee events, at Nationals, at Worlds. This is Seth from DC. Hi, Seth.
Hey, how are you guys?
So, Seth, you're a pretty good Melee player, I hear.
I consider myself a particularly good Melee player. I had two good tournaments last year, but Melee is, it's tougher than Joust.
That's an interesting statement. I'm probably just going to start bothering you about that. Why is it tougher than Joust?
In Joust, you test so much, and you get to the point where you can, if you're really at the peak of your game and you're a competitive player, it's easy to evaluate everything that's going on with the two players. There's just two board states, two sets of cards, two character rows, etc. But then you get into Melee, and there's no possible way to easily keep track of so many cards and so many different maneuvers. So you can't apply that approach to Joust where you really see the whole table to Melee. It's much more of a feel and a flow, and I find that a lot more difficult.
I would expand upon that and say that it's not just that the board states are complicated, it's that you can't test against all the different players you're going to meet. And the way that they approach the game is going to change things considerably more in Melee than they will in Joust.
Yeah, I definitely agree. The personal aspect, but even then, that's not what I find so challenging. It's just the sheer number of things on the table, and I'm so used to knowing everything on the table. When you're really ready for a big event in Joust, you just don't miss things very much. And you can't get to that point with Melee. At least I don't feel like I can.
You can't anticipate everyone's cards that everyone would have in their hands and the different ways they could mess with you, or worse, join together to mess with you. You could look over at a single player and say, okay, so he could put to the sword this guy. That would still let me win, but it'd be annoying. But what you're forgetting is that if you looked at the next player and said, well, then he could follow up with a Tears of Lys, and that would cost me the game. That's where these permutations start to get complicated. So I agree with you. I think it's a harder game, and I think there's actually different skill sets involved in Melee than in Joust as well. I think you build your decks differently. I think you have to evaluate cards differently, and I think you use some soft skills that you don't need to use in Joust.
Stuff like table talk.
So soft skills is not a term I've heard before, so John may have to expand on that. I certainly heard table talk, but...
Well, soft skills in general is those social skills. In Joust, I could grunt at you, tell you strengths and basic plays, and we'd be okay. You do that at a Melee table, and you're that guy that no one likes because you're being antisocial. So those soft skills are your social skills. Your ability to make deals, your ability to negotiate with fellow players, your ability to convince someone to not let Seth win the game.
Well, that seems to have worked so far.
Yeah. Too many final tables. Final table, Seth.
Yeah, even in Joust, I seem good at convincing my opponent not to let me win the game.
Those final tables in Melee, you know, that last round, it really is a much different game than earlier rounds, too. So the way Melee's played changes, I think, as a tournament goes on, which is a very interesting aspect for me, because those early rounds, people are more willing to negotiate. They're jockeying for position to make the cut. And that's a very legitimate way to play. You're trying to win the tournament. The best way to win the tournament is to make the cut. But once you've made the cut, only the winner moves on.
Single elimination, yeah.
Yeah. Now the game changes a little bit. I'm not willing to make a deal that's only going to get me second place. I'm not playing for points here. I'm playing to take this table. And that means you have to kind of shift mindsets after the cut. I find that an interesting aspect that a lot of people forget.
Yeah, it's not necessarily an aspect I like. The fact that there are almost three different phases of a Melee tournament, the first being, you know, the first two rounds or whatever, the third being the last round where if you've already won, you don't need to jostle for position at all.
Half the players are desperate and the other one might not care.
Exactly. And then the cut, where any matches in the cut are all identical. You're fighting for that first place, unless you're me and you hand Kid Seafeltz's win so you can claim your overall title. But yeah, so I mean, I don't like it that much in Joust either. I don't like how the Swiss rounds then change into the cut and losses are valued differently, and I've talked about that as well. But I feel that Melee has those phases, and it makes it a very different game in the cut. But it also is a very different game because the Swiss rounds are supposedly not Swiss rounds at all. They're random pairings. And once you get to the cut, you know you're playing with four players who have done very well and are strong players, because a weak player can make a melee table very irritating to play. When people aren't acting in what you know are their own best interests, the behavior becomes very difficult to predict.
And then that social aspect comes out, and you can't just be patronizing to this one person, but you need them to step up so that someone doesn't win.
Yeah. And trying to convince people to act in their own best interests.
Right. But like you're saying, they have a different perspective on the game because maybe they have a less exposure. They're not like you or Seth. They haven't played 10 million games. They're here to have a good time. And all tournaments, that should be your main objective. And I know, Seth, you have the best time when you're winning. But these other players, because they haven't played the reps, they might actually not know the intricacies that you're taking for granted. So because of that, they're making plays that you think are wrong, but they think is in their best interest. And they just think you tried to trick them again.
I think you touched on a point there that's a good spot for us to jump onto, which is a lot of the listeners you have probably have never played in a Melee tournament. And it's worth pointing out that the community mostly plays Melee at Gen Con or the World Championship or in Europe at Stalic and some other odd tournaments in Europe as well. But a lot of the players in a Melee tournament might not have played Melee before. A lot of the players, the last time they played might have been last Gen Con or last Worlds or whatever. So it's not, it's just a very different environment, very different feel from a Joust tournament.
I mean, it's harder to get games in, right? And harder to get tested because it's not just you and a buddy. You have to have, at least three, preferably four people at your table to play. So sometimes it's hard to get that critical mass. I know, actually, Alex, you play pretty regularly at your...
Yeah, we generally get a Melee game in this week, on top of the chess games we do. And it's actually been quite an interesting experience for me because I basically didn't have a meta before. So I was one of those people, like Seth said. I got to play lots of Joust on Octagon, but I got to play Melee at Gen Con and Worlds. And I only attended one of those. So, it's once a year. And in teaching it to other players, I've noticed a lot of things, conventions that I take for granted in Melee that sort of other players don't follow, and it gives me, in some cases, it gives me a tremendous amount of space to work with and walk away with tables, but sometimes it just creates a very, very different dynamic. And the first one that I think is worth mentioning is, and I think it's a very European one originally, it's that eliminating a player from a Melee table is very, very rarely in your best interests. For a number of reasons. So picking up and wiping out their board leaves them exposed for everybody else to take advantage of the hard work that you've put in. And secondly, a player who is out of the running is a very unpredictable force at the table. They can be vindictive without losing standing. They can attack you because you, wiped out their last important character. And so it's extremely important as a Melee player in general to keep size balanced enough that you don't have this window for everybody to pounce on from your hard work. And that's something that my meta has definitely understood very, very quickly. But in the first few games, where they were completely eliminating a player, there was space for me to run away with games.
Yeah, because now you're just saying, my deck is faster than yours, or I hope it is, and we're going to use this hole I've created. But if you've used all these events and other things to create that hole, most likely you're not the fastest deck.
I think it's worth stepping in here to point out, relative to what you're saying, Alex, that most Melee games, the majority of Melee games, end where someone starts their turn and they have 8 to 11 power and then they get to 15. So when you're saying take one player out of the game, for example, if they have no standing characters left and then it comes to me and I have 9 power, I'm going to go unopposed, play a power claim event, whatever the case is, and I can get to 15 very easily. So because of the nature of how Melee works, where someone leaps to get that last 4 or 5 or whatever it is, leaving someone open where they can't do anything about it, you're just setting someone up to win.
I think you raised a good point, Seth. You've kind of talked that the strategy in Melee is different than Joust, because in Joust, you can have all these different win conditions and all these different play styles. But in Melee, your play styles and the type of deck you're playing, I would say, get refined a little bit more. You're not going to see a deck that controls a single player very well in Melee. You're going to either try to be controlling all the players somehow, or you're going to be playing a deck that relies more on itself, right, where you can get renown or you can play big characters or big events. I don't think you're going to see a Targ burn deck that's focused on killing or burning one character unless you're going to be using that as leverage to kind of negotiate things with your opponents. And then you're not really playing a burn deck. You're just playing something that gives you a few advantages to negotiate. You're probably still playing some kind of power rush. Do you guys think that's true?
Yeah, I think it's also worth noting that I don't think the control decks for Melee are there yet, and they took a long time to get to the competitive scene in first edition as well. It was a while until some of the just crazy fast stuff was slowed down a little bit by some restrictions, and the more control decks got some of the tools that wound up being borderline broken in Joust but weren't restricted in Melee, and therefore allowed the control decks to sort of keep the pace. And I think we're nowhere near that yet, where if you had two control decks at the table, you could have a sort of control lock on the board.
I think the history of Melee in 1.0 is basically that there were rush decks and then really bad Melee decks. And then there were rush decks, a lot of bad Melee decks, and some good control decks. But basically, there's not as many archetypes as people want there to be ever. People try to do things in Melee that don't win tables.
Yeah, I think you're looking at, like, especially for 2.0 right now, flavors of rush decks. You know, you're a renown rush, you're an event rush, you're a high claim rush, you're rush. And a lot of that's actually going to be, you know, talking about specific decks, it's going to be on plots. I think, you know, things like Rise of the Kraken, very good melee plot. Again, it's about unopposed rush. You're looking at the tourney that gives your knight characters renown. Now you're giving renown on characters. Again, a type of rush. So in general, I've only played a few games now of 2.0, which is a tragedy, but like you were saying, Seth, it's hard to get enough people involved. I've noticed that at least a lot of the closers for the melee games these days is due to plots.
You mean because they get you extra power either with renown or rise, something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
I think we should probably take a step back and talk about title.
Yeah, like the fact that you can claim two power from titles around?
Exactly. That is one of the first things I want to mention, is that compared to first edition, the fact that every single title, or every single title but one, rivals two other titles, and you can claim one power for rivaling them for each player, so that can put an additional two power to you, has actually proven to be a huge difference. It's much easier to get that rival's power in general. You're more often going to get it. You can more often get two, and it has actually valued more the ability to make those multiple challenges and make sure you can get those rival's challenges in, more than I expected things like renown. Like, in many cases, I would rather have an extra character on the board so I can get that extra challenge in against my rival than perhaps a renowned character. And the second thing that also pushes in this direction right now is the title Hand of the King, which is just amazingly powerful.
It's pretty
and allows, yeah, and allows you to put in a second power challenge, which again values the ability to put more characters on the board. And, you know, if there's an opening somewhere, you can get a tremendous amount of power. I had I mentioned it on the cast before, but I had a terrible Joust deck that was a Martell Banner of the Rose. I think it had, you know, a renowned character in it, but that was about it. And I pulled it out for the Melee game, and I was down to one character, and I had no renown on the board, and I got 9 power in a turn with two rivals and Hand of the King and the Clash of Kings plot. And there's just there are a lot of ways to get power, and I actually think that right now you want to emphasize being able to make multiple challenges almost over anything else right now.
So really, you just want to have a flood of characters on the board.
Or characters that you can make, the extra challenges. At least more so than before, I think.
All right, well, since we're talking about these titles, they're actually significantly different than they were in 1.0, and the way you go about being able to choose them is really different. So how about, Alex, you tell us, since you're the master of titles, obviously, what, you know, how you go about choosing them, and what's your strategy when you're picking between them?
So rules-wise, the way you choose them is nowadays a title, well, depending on the number of players, a certain number of titles are removed from the pool at random before the first player looks at them, which means that the first player will choose, say, one of four or five potential titles.
and then the next player will choose, not knowing exactly what title that person has chosen. And right. So it used to be that in first edition at a three-player table, well, I knew exactly what title the first player had chosen, and I could pick a title that was supported by that and, you know, could completely lock down that game. That's a little bit harder to do because you can't always know which title was lost at random, and it does make it harder for the last player to pick the perfect title for whatever mix of cards has come out.
But it gives the most information to that first player, because that first player can, by looking at the titles that are in his hand, knows exactly which titles have been discarded as well.
He does, but he also has to make a choice, and then the next player has a 50% chance of being able to pick something that's either supported or
not. I'm just looking at these right now. This Master of Coin, this is pretty noob, right? If you pick that Master of Coin, that's a pretty man, just like in first edition.
Seth, why don't you read out the title so that our listeners know exactly what we're talking about in case that they are Jost focus.
Sure. All right. We got six. I'll go through them quickly. Master of Coin. I won't do the support and rival going through this the first time. Master of Coin. The only benefit you get is +2 gold. Hand of the King. You get to make an additional power challenge, but it has to be against a different opponent. And you get +1 strength during power challenges.
Note that additional opponent restriction is who you initiate it against, not who it resolves against. So if you start a challenge against one person and then it gets redirected, then your second challenge can be against the same person it was redirected against. It can't be against the person you launched it against. And same thing for other sort of title restrictions and other things preventing you from initiating challenges. Crown Regents are very strange that way in how they interact with initiating challenges.
Speaking of the Crown Regent, you get +2 strength for dominance, and you get to redirect 1 challenge during the round. And what that means, I assume it works where after the challenge is declared, but before defenders, it's right away. It's before the action window, right?
It's before the action window, and it's after they've declared stealth, but they get to redeclare stealth against the new target. But yeah, you get to say, no, that challenge is not against that person. Pick a new person. You don't get to tell them who they have to go against, and they can't go against themselves, but they can now break a supports restriction, for instance, because they didn't initiate it against someone they supported.
Got it. Master of Laws, you get to draw an extra card and you get +1 reserve. Master of Ships, you raise the claim on your plot card by 1 during mill against your rival or rivals, and +1 strength during mill. And then Master of Whispers, +1 strength during intrigue, and you may resolve your intrigue claim against any number of opponents of your choice.
And again, that any number is kind of interesting. That can be 0. It can be all the players except the one that you actually won the challenge against. So this is a title that I've seen played a little bit, but it's mostly being played wrong in that it's being used to try and turn intrigue attrition from a joust deck into intrigue attrition from a melee deck. And, you know, making everybody lose cards. But really, this is a huge leverage tool where you say, look, let me get the unopposed challenge against you. You're my rival. I won't take any cards from you. You're going to lose nothing. I'm going to take them from everybody else. That's a fair trade. Right then and there, you've gained 2 power from the title.
Here comes a Cersei. This is a claim 2, and it's going to hit everyone but you, sir. Just let it through.
Yep. Sucker, I will take yours.
Exactly.
Now that you've declared no defenders, we're going to renegotiate.
Of all these, I've found the hardest one to get good use out of is the Master of Ships. And it's one of the most appealing to newer players because they're looking for all sorts of neat things and they're thinking of this sort of like a multiple-way joust where damage caused to an opponent brings you up, which is not the case at all. And so I find it's occasionally paid off when you really need to put the pressure on someone who's running away with the game and in combination with other players also launching militaries at that person. But most of the time you're taking this because both of its rivals are going to be there and it's often supported by the Master of Coin. So its support and rivals relations are quite good. People are less likely to take the Master of Whispers often, and therefore you won't be supporting anyone and you'll have open access to the board. I think that's the biggest advantage out of Master of Ships more than anything else.
Well, I think you just explained your strategy for picking the different titles there, Alex, basically.
Oh, I don't generally have a strategy. If I see Master of Laws, I take the card. That seems to be
Really? So, I mean, that's my first question for you is, let's say, I know it's against the rules, but let's say you're first player and you get all six titles and you get to pick first. What do you go for? Because that's when it's tough in first edition. That's where a newer player always wants the money and they go for a master of coin. And then by the time everything shakes out, their support and opposed structure is awful and they're pretty owned.
I find that's true in Melee and second edition as well, as people will tend to do that. The thing is that the valuation of titles changes a lot throughout the game. So Hand of the King is an absolutely amazing title from plot two onwards. But on plot one, unless you're going third or fourth, where you can get a little bit of power but not look too threatening, I mean, it's a terrible first pick as first player on turn one. It's just absolutely awful. Because you don't want to expose yourself by making two power challenges, and you don't want to put that much power on your house while everybody can run away and steal it. So generally, on turn one, you're probably looking at either building up board position with Master of Laws, Master of Coin, or protecting yourself with Crown Regent, and those are sort of the three that are worth looking at as first player on turn one. I think that changes a lot as the game progresses.
Sure.
A lot of Melee now, Alex and Seth, you have a good background 1.0. Do you guys have any tips or tricks for Melee? So if I was a new player and I was building a deck, we said that you should build some variety of rush. But now I'm sitting down at my first table and I'm playing this game. What would be the tips and tricks that you'd say? Alex, you gave a good one earlier as an example. You said, put out as many characters as you possibly can. That's what I basically heard from you. Get as many challenges as you can.
Yep.
Are there others?
Oh, definitely. One goes back to the deck building. You said they've already built their deck, but in building your deck and in playing, look for cards that can affect anyone. You look at Marjorie Tyrell, and you can strength pump someone else's character. The Iron Fleet Scout can pump someone else's Greyjoy character. Dracarys can burn a character that's in somebody else's challenge that you're not involved in. And those are cards that gain much more value in Melee. I have won Melee games by convincing people to use Marjorie on my own characters so that I can put a put to the sword to get rid of someone else's problematic character and then not do it or whatever the case is just to burn the Marjories. But those cards are tremendously flexible and they're going to give you a negotiating tool and they're going to give you control of situations where you think the game is running away from you because of the actions of other players. You can still make sure that the game sort of plays out along the lines that you were hoping it would.
Yeah, I mean, my main advice would actually be deck building. Sorry, John, to cut against what you're looking for. But, like, my main advice is people, for a couple of reasons, like to put bad cards in their Melee decks even more than Joust. And one of those reasons is people don't play it that much. They don't practice that much. So they don't feel like they have to take it seriously so they can put more cards they think
are fun. Which is fine. I mean, if you're just going to have fun, you're going to have fun.
But then also people use that logic. We talk so much about negotiating, and we talk a lot about like table talk and things like that. So people will put bad cards in their deck because they think to themselves, oh, but I can use this in XYZ way to negotiate. Whereas if that card is just a character that wins you a challenge, or just put good cards in your deck that win games. Some cards, I agree with you, Alex, like some cards, it's an added bonus if they give you other opportunities, but you can't focus on just affecting multiple people or negotiating and then putting junk cards in.
And the other stage of deck building, we mentioned rush, but really there's the aspect of explosive rush being even more important. And you get more of it from the titles than you used to, but cards like Superior Claim, like Lady Sansa's Rose, anything that can surprise people. And if you're being surprised by Lady Sansa's Rose, you're already in trouble. But you should expect that card coming every time a knight is attacking or defending alone. Really, cards that come from hand and speed up that power gain in a way that other players weren't necessarily ready for, those are what are going to allow you to run away with a game even when the other people were prepared.
Yeah, that was one of the tips and tricks I would say, that you really want to look like you're somewhere in the middle of the pack, that you could win, but you're never the best player until the round you take it home. You don't want to be the guy sitting at 12 power at the start of round 3 while everyone else is at 6 or 7, because now you've got this giant target on. You want to be the guy that's sitting at 9 power. There's some other guy at 11, and people will be like, okay, we're going to let the guy with 9 power go first, and you're going to like, great, I'll win now. So you really want those explosive cards.
That's actually another point that you mentioned. So we'll let that guy go first. this is just as true in first edition as it was, or in second edition as it was in first, initiative. Initiative is insanely important in Melee. First couple of turns, on the first turn, maybe it doesn't matter as much. You might get a better title, or you might get a better position at the board.
You want to go last, right? Right until the turn you win.
Well, yes and no. You certainly want to go last if you're going to use something like Hand of the King. There'll be a lot more openings for your challenges. But if you can close by going first, you want to do that too, and you want to have control over that. And chances are really high that even a bad plot like Sneak Attack, the fact that it has 11 initiative, and if you're at 9 power and someone else is at 15 and you can close on that power challenge, then Sneak Attack becomes a really good plot just because it has that 11 initiative. And so I think you need to be able to, at least on one important turn, control initiative. And sure, lots of people will play Clash of Kings, and you may think that's your initiative winning plot, but if you don't have an initiative boost, and or you don't have lower power than other people, chances are you're going to have a 9 versus 9. So even having an 11 initiative plot is kind of important.
I agree with you. Initiative is really, really important, and going first is bad unless you're about to win. In the World Championship last year, I think I went first every round but one. I mean, that was only because Ryan Jones and Corey, they were colluding to keep me, out of that overall contention. But you have to put up with that stuff in Melee.
Yeah, Corey's known for that. I mean, holding you down.
He incinerated me at Gen Con, kept me from winning there, too.
Seth, I have a question. Is it possible for a card to be bad in Joust but good in Melee?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question. Yes, definitely. Certain cards that do that are ones that affect all players. Like, that's the easiest text where something says opponents must X or opponents do X or each player must X. You know, in Joust, maybe that power isn't that good, but when you get it three times over, then it becomes quite good.
So we talked about deck building now a little bit, and we talked about the fact that when you're playing, there's a different skill set. How important are the soft skills? Because Seth, you seem to be alluding that you didn't think they were as important as people make them out to be, that if you play a good deck and you play well at Melee, the soft skills aren't as important aspect as some people like myself think they are.
I feel like that. I do feel that the soft skills get oversold in Melee. I think you can ride a better deck and a solid game to wins. I think especially because the board is so complicated. If you really have a good understanding of the game, the challenge math, and power totals, and what people might have in their hand, if you can bring a little more of that to bear, I think you can still be fine.
I actually mostly agree with Seth on this one, on the soft skills. I think that in the first couple of rounds where you're regularly going to have players whose behavior is less predictable and more easily manipulated and aren't quite clear what their best interests are, I don't mean more easily manipulated and soft-minded or anything, but it's just that they don't have the experience with the table, with recognizing where the threats are coming from. Then there's a lot of influence that can be placed on those players from the soft skills. But I think that when you're getting to those cut tables, it becomes less important.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you can definitely, you know, make the deals that help you a little bit more and you can get that edge, but I don't think the edge is anywhere near what a lot of people claim it to be once you get to the tables where everybody has a lot of experience with Melee.
All right, talking about deals, what's your stance? Some people never break them. Some people break them to win. Some people just break them for fun.
I will break a deal to win. In fact, I try to make as many deals as possible where it is advantageous to both players. And if it ceases to be, if keeping the deal is going to harm my chances of making first, then I'm not going to keep that deal, and I would not expect someone else to do it either. Making the deal where it doesn't significantly hamper my chance of getting first, then that's fine. I'm willing to trade small benefits for small benefits all the time, but I'm not going to sit there and let someone else run away with the game just because I said I wouldn't do challenges against them. I think it's within the spirit of the game to break that deal to stop them from winning.
I think making and breaking deals is kind of overrated in the sense that the actual content of the deals are less important than people think. But what is important about making deals with people or negotiating deals is it's a way to communicate about the game in a way that people feel more than you just telling them. So
I really like that. That's excellent. Go on, Seth.
It's a good way to make people realize how far ahead someone is, as opposed to just saying this person is going to win. When you explain, you need to do this, I will do this, and he will do this so that we can keep him from winning. So you've made a deal and you're all in it together, and people see that everybody's kind of pitching in and they recognize this person will win otherwise. You're able to lay it out in a more comprehensive way, as opposed to just saying, do everything you can to stop him. It doesn't serve. It's harder to comprehend.
It's more visceral. And more engaging. I think I agree.
So I know there's some players that firmly believe that deals are an important aspect of the game. And if someone breaks them all the time, they're less likely to trust them in future Melee tournaments. And it's one of the reasons that I myself don't like to break deals. In fact, the one time I did versus Dan, it totally blew up in my face. And I got a terrible taste in my mouth after that. And ever since then, I've stuck with my deals like Dan does. But I think, Seth, it's because I'm gonna flip-flop a little here and say that I don't think they're as impactful as people seem to think. I hear players after Melee sometimes say, well, you know, Joe talked to Sally and Sally decided to side with him and the two of them both got this benefit, but that's why Joe won. And I think Alex mentioned it. If it profits both players a little bit, they're going to do it. Don't think that's the reason that you lost the Melee table. There was other things at play there. Similar to what we were saying in Joust, that you can't blame it on bad luck all the time. You can't blame it. There's other things going on and maybe small play mistakes that take a while for you to figure out.
Seth, you mentioned that a good signal on a card that might be bad in Joust but good in Melee is if it affects all players. And I put it to you that that means that the card is probably as good in Melee as it was in Joust. For instance, Even-Handed Justice is a very good card in Joust because you can kneel their biggest character. And it's a very good card in Melee because you can do that same aggressive thing to all of your opponents, therefore putting you up relative to all your opponents by the same amount it does in Joust. The same thing with, for instance, an intrigue challenge in Melee is taking a card or two out of one person's hand, so it's not very good, because two other players are also benefiting from that relative disparity. But if you use it with the Master of Whispers title against everybody, then you're getting the same benefit as you were in Joust. You're not getting more. The people who are like, man, now it works against three players. I see that being the cap is it'll be as good as it was in Joust.
There are some cards, though, that actually improve in Melee. And because of this rush where we wanted to have this surprise for power. So a really good example is actually the Bone Ways, where you might be affected and lose multiple challenges against more people. It can serve as a deterrent. I think people have been using it as a power generating tool in Joust recently, and it's definitely a good deterrent. People will say if that gives you the one more token you need to get your three power, they're going to be less likely to attack you, I think.
Well, let me ask you this. Here's the best example of cards that are better in Melee than Joust. How many of the winning deck lists, not just for regionals, but like store championships and going all the way back to Startup 2.0, how many winning deck lists have had superior claim? And I assure you, that card will be in many every winning Melee deck. Yes.
Yeah.
And part of that's just because event space, rush always gets you to 15, but cards that damage people or control people, they often only affect one person. So like Tears is a great Joust card. Nowhere near as good in Melee because you need to compete with three people, not just one guy.
There are some other cards in this start box that I think are worthy of mention as Melee-centric cards. Ahead of the Tide is a +3 initiative boost, which is enough to put a Clash of Kings ahead of a Sneak Attack. So I think it actually has a fair bit of value there. And the Army, if any player has a war plot revealed, is now doing a 4-power swing rather than a 2-power swing. And, I've actually seen a fair bit of trading the Pintoshi in that kind of play. Gold is a little more plentiful, especially in the early constructive phases of the game. And I think that Army is a good card in Melee. And I think that Ahead of the Tide is a good card in Melee.
Yeah, and I would never put Ahead of the Tide in a Joust deck right now.
Nor would I.
I mean, Seth would, right, Seth?
I'm not sure. I wish you guys had brought that up when you talked to Danny on the last cast. There were a couple cards. I wish you had gotten a little more aggressive. You can't just get him, let him get away with, oh yeah, Green Dreams is really interesting. No, make good cards, Danny. Don't make this shitty attachment.
Danny was thinking about Melee when he did Ahead of the Tide, and that's respectable because it's part of the game. I think we've covered the basic topics of Melee and some of the key cards. But I want to ask you a question, Seth. And do you think Melee can be competitive? Is Melee something they should be doing competitively? We've seen some articles come up on their site recently about Melee. Kennan kind of wrote about this. Alex has said a few times, though, that they should either kind of say that Melee is competitive, have proper tournament rules, or just shut it down.
Well, I haven't advocated that, but I said that if they're going to claim all this, then it's equal format, then it needs to be supported throughout. Through store championship season, through regional season, through having tournament rules released at the same time rather than currently not releasing.
Either do Melee or don't. Because you're saying if it's an equal format, basically say it's not an equal format or increase your support.
I think Melee doesn't work as a competitive format in the way that Joust does. I mean, you can maybe have a Melee tournament with some sort of basic prize structure that doesn't reward first place over much. But the problem is, I mean, look at the World Championship final table last year. The designer of the game is the head judge, and yet still so much controversy. It's just not a good tournament game. Like, that should never happen in Joust. If Nate is the judge standing next to a Joust table, you would expect after the game there wouldn't be an uproar over, like, controversial rules issues.
I mean, I don't know if you've heard of this Star Wars X-Wing tournament that happened last week that happened entirely according to the rules and yet still has a huge controversy behind it.
Because of the intentional draws.
Because the top four tables intentional drew their way into the cut, into the top eight.
There's no question of cheating or poor judgment there. It's a accusation of flaws in the rules, and I think that's a difference with Melee, is that people walk away from tables feeling like, I'm not sure if that was allowed, and I don't feel right about that. And that's why to have it as a competitive format where you get the same card design you do for Joust, it's just not well thought out as it exists currently.
Yeah, I think that's a reflection again of the rules. I think that the rules need to be a little bit more specific. They have to accept certain aspects of Melee and just say that, you know, this is okay or this isn't okay so that everyone understands what's going on. Because those types of conversations that you're talking about, Seth, don't actually happen in France or in Shalik and stuff like this. Like, they have these huge Melee tournaments with way more players than we've had, and they never come out with these dirty tastes or whatever you want to call it.
Wait. Did John just say blame the meta, not the game?
I said,
okay.
Because nobody cares who wins Melee and Stalag. They don't get card design. It's like, oh, some guy. Yeah, well, congratulations. Well,
it used to be just from the it was just from the Joust, wasn't it? Wasn't there a Melee card design? Marjorie Tyrell was Melee?
In like 2009. When was that?
And Desert Raider? Was that not Melee?
No, that was Chinese champion.
No. That was Istvan Serdi. That was, I believe, Melee.
That was Melee.
Man, that's when were those cards? When were those Melee tournaments?
2012 for Desert Raider and 2011 Melee champion.
I think what's most important here is that they do have big prizes on the line, sometimes card designs. And what the European community is saying is because we approach Melee differently and they have this set of rules, I'm going to say that's more firmly established than FFG, and that might just be a meta thing where they've come together because they play it so much more to make these unofficial rules that they follow. It reduces the opportunity for people to leave a table and feel that something unjust happened because they have these more detailed but non-official rules.
Do you really drink that Kool-Aid, John? You really believe all this European bullshit? They play Melee some totally different way. You buy all that?
I don't think they play it differently. I think that they have rules established that FFG doesn't. So a different philosophy to Melee. Sure.
I would be interested to go and play at Stalag and see what it was really like. And I suspect it would not strike me as terribly different from the US.
Well, some of the arguments we talked about this last time you were on, but some of the arguments they use to justify the way it happens is like, well, if I sat down with a metamate, I would do my best to make sure they lost. I'm like, well, that's a violation of the rules as well.
Right, that's like, exactly the same.
that, you know, it may not have the same sour result for everybody else at the table, but it's a violation of the rules.
Right, like I said, they're playing by a set of European rules that's probably more detailed than the FFG current rules. And I think FFG needs to just step up and clear up the ambiguity, and then Melee could be a competitive format. But maybe I'm living a pipe dream, because you guys seem to be indicating the other way. But I like Melee.
That's because you are awesome at Melee, John.
Says the guy that's at all the Melee final tables.
And lost. You won your final table. Alex and I are just pale imitations.
Hey.
Is there anything else either of you want to add about Melee, or a key trick, key tip, something about deck building, anything at all? Or do you think we've said everything that's, at least at a very general level, that's important about Melee?
I think one other tip that I had in my head just from our discussion earlier is you have to, as much as you don't want to be put the target on your back, you have to take your opportunities. I mean, if you have two superior claims in your hand, just play one on the first round. Like, if it puts you ahead, it puts you ahead. But sometimes you just have to get what's yours when you have the opportunity. Don't outthink yourself. Don't, like, overthink the situation. Just get some power. Try to win. If you have one superior claim and you want to save it for the next round, maybe that makes sense. But just don't overthink because you're outside of a joust setting. A lot of those, like, just try to win, just like you're playing Joust.
All right, Seth, thank you so much for coming on at short notice again and giving us a competitive player's opinion on Melee, which you do quite well in, even if the opinion is Melee shouldn't be competitive.
I mean, it's funny because Melee is no doubt extremely skill-based. You see the same people succeeding. Alex has said that many times. It is very skill-based, probably even more skill-based than Joust, and yet...
That's why Corey Faraday's at, like, every single final table for Melee if he doesn't drop.
If he doesn't drop.
It's true. But I think every time that this comes up, because you're right, these same players are making the cut, which suggests that it certainly can be a competitive experience, but then you have the issue of perceived collusion and perceived deals and whether the judges have to make calls as to whether you're playing suboptimally because you're an idiot or suboptimally because you're trying to help a friend. You're making a deal which could be considered idiotic because it harms you. You know, it becomes very, very difficult. But other board game tournaments exist for games with multiple players all competing towards only one attainable goal. And they definitely do exist. And some of them are rewarded with big money prizes as well. There has got to be a way to structure the tournament in such a way that you can maintain the competitive integrity of the tournament without having a huge burden on the judges. There has to be.
I think you're probably right. Yeah, I also don't know what it is. I mean, they have diplomacy tournaments. They have world championships. So certainly there couldn't be more collusion in Melee than, or more potential or more issue, more ambiguity than there is in diplomacy, and yet they managed to pull it all.
Maybe they just don't have a DC.
Oh, come on, John. You cut it there, so it sounds like I'm blaming DC for all our problems? Tisk tisk.
Welcome to the crazy Alex shack in the woods, where Alex rants about stuff. Go, Alex.
I just get increasingly frustrated, irritated. I wish I could do the sort of Lewis Black, really angry voice and shaking with anyway, there's just
spittle.
Yeah, it would really work for this. People, Lannister is doing very well, and people know this, and people are playing Lannister, and it's doing about as well as they're playing it. This is a normal thing in the meta. Eventually, something else will emerge. It happened with Baera. It happened with Greyjoy. It happened with Targ. It's gonna happen with Lannister. And sure, at some point, maybe Lannister has been the top deck for too long, and that's gonna be an issue. And I don't think we're there yet. But none of that matters for the way that people approach talking about Lannister cards, and it drives me nuts. They see a bad card like Small Council Chambers that if it was the same text in any other faction, they would call it, in their own faction, they would call it a terrible card. But because it's Lannister, it's for some reason a good card, and it's for some reason going to be hugely destructive. And they're so quick to do this with every single card that comes out for Lannister. Like the Crossroads Sellsword, which I think is a terrible card.
Oh, it's horrible.
Worse than the Gold Cloaks, and yet people are talking about it being a good card. The Small Council Chambers, same sort of thing. I think people are losing their shit over Trial by Combat, which is card disadvantage that has occasional uses, but involves spending 2 gold and not getting a certain claim to get a different claim and a card to do it. It's not really significantly better than a...
Put to the Sword?
Put to the Sword. Or
you get to choose the claim. Yeah.
And so... You need to step back and know, yes, Lannister is good. There are reasons it's good. These aren't the reasons it's good.
Yeah.
And just try and imagine the card that you're seeing there in your own faction. And, if it's Small Council Chambers, imagine it's off winning a military challenge for Stark or Targ or whatever. And you'd be like, no, I wouldn't run that. So why would it be that great in Lannister? There are things those cards do, but they're not just effortless thought ins that are making Lannister continuously better.
If you're going to scream about Lannister cards, scream about really good Lannister cards, like Tower of the Hand.
Even Tower of the Hand is, it fits in a specific deck.
It's way better than these other ones you've mentioned.
It is way better than those other ones. Yeah, I don't think people are very good at recognizing why Lannister is beating them. And the second thing is that as Lannister does get all of these, they've clearly gotten excellent cards. Some of them absolutely amazing. But
they have
because
the mountain
of that,
Alex.
The addition of a good card to Lannister suddenly becomes sometimes a card that won't go in. Maybe you'd play Crossroads Sellswords in another faction, but you won't because Gold Cloaks is better. And it's always better. And so you're going to run Gold Cloaks. And, you can say the same thing. It's going to be a long time before you replace the Hound. So you have to evaluate against things they already have as well. Now, this isn't to say that Illyn isn't an amazing card. That's one that's coming out.
Yes,
it
he's
isn't
very
to say
good.
That there aren't good cards for Lannister. I think Bronn is very, very solid. But I think interesting, but very, very good. But Trial by Combat should not be the one that people are anyway.
Yeah, I think Illyn Payne is more effective because, you play that bugger and he really hurts those burn decks, eating up all those dragons.
Yeah, he can play Whack a Dragon. I think that will be rather interesting.
Yeah.
Is he a lord? He's not a lord, is he?
I think he is.
No, he's just a knight. Good.
Just a knight. All right, anything else you want to rant about? This is your time.
No, it was a short rant. Is there a way that we can pretend that was a tip of the week? Tip of the week, evaluate cards based on what they're actually good or not, and not whether the faction is. I don't know.
Sure, we'll let you pretend.
It's a stretch. We'll let it stand. All right, closing comments, John. I don't necessarily have all that much for closing comments. I do have a few things I forgot to mention in the intro. The first is that I know some people have been having trouble with our RSS feed. That should have been a one-off thing last week. It had to do with the fact that I updated it with a time in the future, and it screwed up iTunes and a couple of other podcatchers. If you unsubbed and resubbed, you were resynchronized. Hopefully this week, where I don't do that screw up, the whole thing will sort itself out automatically. So in theory, you shouldn't have to worry about anything, but if you're app that you use to subscribe to this RSS feed still fails this week, please let me know ASAP because it means it's not the problem I think it is.
We do have some upcoming regionals. We have one in Dallas on the Common Ground Games and another one in Hendersonville.
Where's that?
No idea. It's a place in the U.S. I mean, I could Google it, but why?
Hendersonville?
Yeah. I hear you Googling it, so I'll let you do it.
Either North Carolina or Tennessee. Okay, well, somewhere in that general area.
It's that area. I mean, it's exciting, so you should go.
Yeah, and then with the Tourney of the Hand wrapping up, the next big European tournament will be the Dockside Brothel Days on the 7th and 8th of May in Amsterdam. So that's the next big, really big tournament to look out for. All right. Do we have anything else for closing comments?
That's it.
Do you have a snappy sign-off?
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
I realized in editing this that we didn't have an Easter egg, so I figured I'd let some people know that I will be attending the regional in Lille in France at the end of May. So if you're in that area, I'd love to see you.